I was kind of, they didn't have an observer program at the time, and so I ended up kind of being the go-to guy when the director wanted to know something, or a fisherman would tell him, hey, come on our boat and see how we do it. They would send me. I was the young kid, and, you know, send me out. And so I spent a lot of days at sea in the winter in the Gulf of Maine and got to go on quite a few wooden boats. So it's kind of what I do, but I got an opportunity to take a job in Alaska as a fishery analyst, and I jumped on that. Alaska had such a good reputation for the management of the fisheries. Massachusetts did not. They didn't really listen to scientists. So I jumped on that. And so now you know a little bit about me. First of all, whose boat is that? I see you all might know whose boat that is.
Sure.
Excellent. Looks like it might do more than just call, I suspect. Most of the Gulf, Western Gulf boats seem to combination boats, right? Combination.
Is it time to join us? Somebody join us on the teleconference? Probably the radio station. So if you're listening on teleconference, Dave Witherall's presentation can be found at aebfish.org/fed.pdf.
Okay, so I have a few things that I'd like to talk about today, kind of things that are going on at the council level relative to federal managed fisheries that intersect with some of your interests in the Western Gulf. So I'm going to go through a few of these issues, and then I'm going to open it up because there's probably some issues that are burning issues in your mind that I haven't addressed. And while I'm kind of an administrator now and not someone that knows all the details, I might be able to answer your question, or at least I can find out for you. So one of the issues at the council right now is some of the tendering. And another boat picture here. Can you see that? And this issue came up originally when the comprehensive regulations to deal with the latest sea lion lawsuit and you know, we had to expand. We used to just have the rookery and haul-out closures, and then they had the fishery-specific issues. And so the concept of tendering was really to put limits on tendering to slow the pace of the fisheries. And as you all know, the tendering has always been important in the Western Gulf for pollock, so it was left that way. But this line at 157 was put in, and so that the larger boats from Kodiak could fish east of that, and then it would allow some tendering to the west. And as you know, the tenders vessels can't deliver more than 600,000 pounds. And so, but what's happened is that we've seen an increase in, the council's seen an increase in tendering in that area of the Central Gulf 620. And every year, we've seen an increase in the number of, the amount of pollock tendered, the amount of vessels participating, and the number of tenders. And you might think, so what? Well, there are some issues and concerns that have been raised to the council from this increase in tendering. First is an allocation issue. Clearly, the city of Kodiak is concerned, and the process is concerned that there are less deliveries being made to Kodiak. They're going to tenders, and then they go to some of the shore plants in the Western Gulf, or maybe even Unimac. There are concerns from the in-season monitoring branch at National Marine Fisheries Service because they're not getting their data in a timely fashion. The tenders don't report the data the same way a catcher vessel landing would be. It's delayed, and it makes it difficult for them to project when to close the season so that if the tack isn't exceeded. There are also concerns about the estimation of Chinook salmon bycatch. If a tender is taking on multiple deliveries and they all get mixed up in the tank, you can't really estimate where exactly and when those salmon were taken. And there's not a an observer present when the plant unloads pollock from the tender. So what happens is that NIMS has to rely on the observer, at sea observer program, to estimate your salmon bycatch, and that results in a less precise number. And of course, you're limited by your salmon cap now. So you really want to. The concern is that if you have this wide, basically variance, you can't be real precise on what your salmon bycatch is. Well, there are going to be some years where the observer program is going to overestimate from reality what how many salmon were taken, and perhaps like close the fisheries early. The last one is a more recent issue, and it has to do with the new observer program that was put in this year, and that's the way that in the trip selection pool, the definition of a trip didn't include a delivery to a tender, and so one could, of course, make multiple deliveries to a tender, and it wouldn't be a trip because the trip is dock to dock. And so that raises a lot of concerns with NIMS, and so I think that the observer issue will be dealt with in this next year, and they're probably going to redefine what a trip is to prohibit that practice, because they're very concerned about the data that they're getting in that area because of the tenders. The other issues the council is going to be addressing at some point this year. I don't have any idea of what will be done, if anything. I want to talk about the observer program a little bit. Probably, I'm not sure what your experience is with the observer program in the past. If people here have vessels all under 60 feet or some over 60 feet, but I'm sure you're all aware now that that observer program has resulted in some changes and some new understanding of the fisheries with the new observer data coming in, especially from the fixed gear fisheries that we previously didn't have observer information from, some of the small boat longliners, the halibut fisheries as well. So just probably most of you already know this, but just to give you a brief update on how the new observer program was implemented, the two categories of coverage. You have the full coverage category, which includes all the catcher processors and the motherships and, the AFA and the Rockfish Co-op vessels. And then there's the partial coverage category, and basically you're going to have some observer coverage under this year's deployment plan, where the cutoff was 40 feet. And so if your vessel is over 40 feet, you're going to be in some kind of selection pool for an observer. And the split now is whether or not your vessel is above or below 57.5 feet, whether you're in the trip selection pool where there's a randomly assigned trip. You report your trip that you're going to go fishing, and NIMS will tell you whether or not you need to take an observer on the trip. Or if you're a vessel between 40 and 57.5, then you're in this vessel selection pool, and you're assigned an observer for a two-month period. And every trip you take out, you go out to take that observer. Now, if you're in the full coverage, you're in the old pay-as-you-go type situation where you pay your observer cost per day through your contractor. And then the partial coverage category, you're paying a tax of 1.25% to cover the cost of the observer program in the partial coverage category. And every year, as part of this annual deployment plan, NIMS tries to figure out what they have for money, the revenue that they have, and then they can project how much observer coverage they're going to get for the following year, and they can figure out how to deploy the observers, whether put more emphasis on the trip selection pool or more emphasis in the vessel selection pool. Now, of course, one of the things people are interested in relative to observers is, well, observers are costly, and they're intrusive. They're on your boat. They take up space. You've got to go out of your way to pick one up, and it's a hassle, right? So there's a lot of interest in implementing some type of electronic monitoring program. And There are electronic monitoring programs in other areas of the world. For example, in the west coast of Canada, there's an electronic monitoring program. But it's really about whether or not they're complying with some kind of regulation like full retention, something that the camera can see. Either they either you kept it on board or you threw it back. And it's something that under current technology can be done. The council's expressed their goal of not only being able to do that, but also do some other things that we normally think of having your person on board, your person observer doing, and that looking at kind of the catch composition. Can the cameras be situated or used in such a way to be able to determine what you caught? What mix of species did you catch? What sizes? Otherwise, you know, it wouldn't be in full complement of what, you know, your at-sea observers are able to do. So there are a few projects in the works by the various university groups, NIMS, and some others to look at ways to do that. Salmon bycatch. I brought this up because, you know, we've got this program that's soon to be implemented, and let me get into some details. I looked very hard in this picture to see if there was a salmon, and I didn't find any. So the way that the council's addressed salmon bycatch in the Gulf of Alaska is they broke it up into whether or not you're targeting pollock or not. And so back in June of 2011, the council decided to establish a 25,000 fish and a PSC cap for Gulf of Alaska trawl fisheries, and that was split between the Central Gulf and Western Gulf. And the Western Gulf amount is 6,684, and of course, if that cap is reached in any one year, closes the fishery for the rest of the year. As I mentioned before, those salmon have to be retained on the boat, and then they're brought back for the observer to go ahead and, you know, take the biological samples so that they can mostly to get the genetic samples so they can determine the stream of origin of all the bycatch, because that's a critically important issue for Alaska, is whether these fish are coming from, for example, the Asian stocks in Russia and Japan, if they're coming from Western Alaska, which seems to be a concern, and of course Chinook runs are down throughout Alaska, or if maybe they're ESA-listed stocks from down here. So it's a management issue as to whether where they came from, not just the overall amount. So the sampling's important. So that was implemented in the middle of 2012. More recently, the council took action to establish a limit for non-pollock fisheries. So any of the cod trawl fisheries or rockfish trawl fisheries, for example, all of the salmon taken in those fisheries accrue towards these caps. And instead of having a central and western Gulf split like they did for the pollock fishery, they decided to just split it up into catcher processor and catcher vessel. And so each group gets their amount of Chinook salmon that they have to deal with, and there's a set aside for the rockfish program, and then there's the rest available to the other fisheries. One of the provisions that was put in, and this was just decided in June of this past year, but one of the provisions that was put in when the council decided to set these caps was kind of what they call an uncertainty pool, and that's another 1,000 Chinook salmon that if you don't reach your cap in the first year, you can access this extra cap the next year, this extra amount of salmon. So it's an idea to be incentive to, if you work to avoid salmon bycatch in year one, you can get more salmon in year two. But when you get, once you've accessed that salmon, you don't get it next year. So if you pick off that extra 1,000 fish in year two, you won't get it in year three. But it's to be able to adapt when some year you get a big salmon run, or you really hit them for some reason, they were aggregated in the same spot as where you were fishing. Again, you've got the full retention of salmon for the biological sampling. Another thing about me, I'm kind of a history buff when it comes to cod fisheries, and so I try to put in fun pictures like this. But it also reminds me that things change. You know, 100 years ago, we would have been using the halibut for bait to catch codfish. You know, so things change. And halibut bycatch is still a big issue at the council. I think most of you are aware that we've been operating under a 2,000 metric ton PSC limit for the trawl fleet for a number of years. And in June of 2012, the council decided that given the condition of the halibut resource, that it was a better allocation to reduce the PSC limit for trawl fisheries by 15% over 3 years. So the first year jump will be 7%. And that's scheduled to be implemented next year, 2014. This is my last topic. But we, as you know, the council has made several attempts to try and so-called rationalize the fisheries in the Gulf of Alaska, like Bering Sea operates under mostly co-ops and other catch-share type systems. It's been more challenging in the Gulf of Alaska for a lot of reasons. And in the past, when we've attempted to do this, the council's attempted to do this, they've been plagued by really kind of not having an established group of players. There was enough latent licenses that weren't being fished. There was effort that was shifting from Western Gulf, Central Gulf, across all gear types. And it seemed, in the end, it was too unstable, and the political will just wasn't there to make a decision. And so I think after seeing all that, and I see reading the tea leaves and seeing where things are going, I think that this latest initiative that looks just at trawl fisheries has probably got some legs. And so if you're in any way a player in those fisheries, you probably want to watch this very closely and participate with comments as much as you can, because things are starting to coalesce. While it started, this initiative started about a year ago. They went through a process where they took proposals for programs. They opened it up for groups, and I think there was a proposal from Aleutian East. And the council looked at all of those proposals and kind of decided that, well, they'll take all these ideas and kind of work through them and discard the ones that didn't make sense and put it together back around a kind of a framework type program. So they pared down all the little stuff, and this is what they're focusing on right now. And our staff is going to produce really a discussion about what these kind of options might mean for a fishery down the road. And so we're looking at perhaps having some kind of a cooperative structure that's based around your shore plant delivery. So you probably have a co-op in Sandpoint, a co-op in King Cove, and we would be looking at issuing quota shares, basically harvest quota for peacod and pollock, and based on some historical catch associated with your license. Of course, the years that get chosen for your years of history that get chosen for your allocation, that hasn't been determined, but that's a pretty darn big decision, because that initial allocation is going to determine what basically the value of your quota share is. Your salmon and halibut PSC would be apportioned based on how much cod and pollock you caught. So your kind of your bycatch amounts are carried along with your target amounts based maybe on some average of bycatch rate or what have you, but this way you're not rewarding fisher maybe vessels that traditionally had a much higher bycatch rate. You're not rewarding them with higher bycatch amounts. it'll be kind of a pro rata washout for everybody. Again, the council's interested, of course, in transferability of both the harvest shares and PSC to maximize efficiency among the fleet, and this would be something that has value. It would be severable, transferable, probably saleable. So, again, that initial allocation is going to give you a lot of value, but how much gets initially allocated will be a very big decision, and I would argue that it's worth your time to participate in this process to the extent you can. If this program is going to affect you, make sure you come to that April meeting and participate, because I think that's going to be a pivotal decision point for this program. So that was all I had for issues that's going on with the council. Like I said, I'm kind of an administrator now, so I don't know all the details of everything, but I can read tea leaves and be able to help you out there. Or are there other issues that I've missed that you want to talk about?
Well, the hard caps put us under. I'm a catcher, vessel owner, and so I think we really are under the gun to get to a point where we can start looking at. I mean, I'm a fisherman, so I know how fishermen work. At some point, we're going to get into excluders and all kinds of things to try and deal with these hard caps. But so the hard cap has been put on before the answer to the problem has been done. And so I guess the timeline is going to be critical to us. I mean, the first time one of our major fisheries gets shut down because of hitting one of these caps, it's just going to be it's going to be terrible. You know, it's going to be a big mess. And so, you know, I think all of us want to get the other answer in and try and figure out what the heck we're going to do about it. And so I'm curious about what your timeline is for, I mean, is this like a 5-year project or a 3-year project or a 10-year project? Or, I mean, I love the way Cora cut to the chase and the motion last time, but it still leaves a lot of stuff open. And I just don't know where you guys are at from your end.
I think the council is very aware of what could happen if your fleet hits that cap. We do pretty extensive analysis, and you know, I can't remember how many years that in the based on past history your fleet would hit the cap, but certainly it would. And it has the potential to, and yeah, it'll shut the fleet down and cost a lot of money to you individually and to communities and all the trickle-down effects. That's right. And so, that's the impetus for putting in some type of catch share system, and that's one of the reasons why I think that this one is going to go. Some way, shape, or form, this catch share program is going to get approved and implemented. And in terms of timeline, I'd say that the time to get this done, of course, takes longer to evaluate a catch share program than probably any other management action that's taken by the council, and that's really because the effects of that initial allocation, that initial decision of how much does everybody get, and that's a tough battle among yourselves, really. It's how much are you going to get? And you know, that money, if we want to change the allocation years to benefit me, it's probably going to not benefit you, so you're not going to like it. And that's the hardest challenge, is when for the council to make it, has to finally make the decision to say, these are the years that we think will have perhaps benefit to everybody and cost equally to everybody. It's not an easy decision. I've never had to make one of those decisions, but, golly, you know, the stories are really tough because it's always somebody has some problem. You know, I've had 2 years, my engine blew up, and I didn't get to participate. You know, it's really tough, I think, for the decision makers to decide, well, maybe we'll exclude 1 year. Do we exclude 1 year? Do we exclude 2 years?
Yeah, Well, I think
from
we
the,
need a good
from the
data
database.
Set so that we can, you know, that has some clarity to it so we can all make, you know, push. I mean, it's going to end up everybody pushing what's going to work best for them. And then,
right.
Big, I mean.
That's right. So, given that I think that there is a lot of momentum for this thing, we've got the National Marine Fisheries Service, who is absolutely pro catch shares right now. Given the interest in salmon bycatch and understanding what the effects would be on the fleet for a closure, this thing is, from a council standpoint, is fast track. And so I think the council will be poised for a decision, not necessarily by the end of December 2014, but probably early 2015. But that, you know how our process works. It takes a couple of years to get things implemented because federal regulations, unlike the state regulations, where changes get made through the Board of Fisheries from proposals and bang, the next year it's the law. The federal government has to, the wheels move very slowly because we have to comply with about 30 some odd laws, and it has to go through a whole long public process after the council. And it has to go through all of the attorney review to get approved to be able to, they want to bulletproof because there's something wrong, right? So you got to add on at least a year after the council decision before you can implement it. If you wanted to push it as fast as possible in April, then you would be trying to get down to the nitty-gritty of what that program would be, so the staff could analyze it and set the council up for final action as soon as possible. But what the tendency is to add more options. Add more options. Oh, you know, we got to take care of my guys. You know, as a council member, they are under a lot of pressure from their own constituent groups to be able to put their concerns in the motion. So, if, you know, my guys really want some set of allocation years, but another council says, my guys want a different set of allocation, well, they're going to say, okay, we'll analyze both. And now you start, the tendency is to add all these options to the analysis. Our analysis gets big, and now it's really hard to predict what the effects are. And it takes longer. It takes longer to get the analysis done. It takes longer to come to agreement on the decision. Sam had his hand up, but hopefully that gives you some insight.
Well, I happen to refer to actual fishermen out here.
Most of the pollock production in the Western Gulf is caught by boats that are a member of a coalition now that Beth Stewart is attending meetings on our behalf and stuff. And we have to coalesce on what our plan is for her, but I hope the council will listen to her because it's our group that. I hope that the council understands that. I don't know what percentage of the production out there, but it's a pretty strong group. I think that we could probably get together among ourselves and figure out what we want and not do the thing of blowing the deal up. What I'm concerned about are some of the community provisions, that kind of thing.
You're right. There are other issues of interest from council members that could potentially expand the scope of the decision and take longer. Certainly, having a representative, and Beth is excellent at what she does, representing your group to the council, and of course Ernie in the AP and Sam when he's a council member. That's important. It's also important if you can find the time and be willing to bear the cost of getting off the boat, flying anchorage, and testifying. And you think, 3 minutes, what the heck does that mean? But you have a lot more influence than that. You talk to council members in the hall, you talk to advisory panel members in the hall, they need to hear your story. They need to hear what the impacts are of doing something to you and your community and your group. What is it you want, first of all, and what is it you don't want and why? It's hard to communicate that in 3 minutes, but there are other opportunities that are not necessarily, you know, behind the microphone where you can influence the decision and educate them. Even if you wouldn't necessarily, you're influencing, but to be able to allow them to, the council members to at least understand what the heck is going on beyond just what they're hearing from staff and in the 3 minute public discussion.
I wanted to bring up one issue there that has to do with I think it's been labeled state waters issues, and the Western Gulf released about half the cod and more than half the pollock. My presumption, I think that of the state, that therefore those fish wouldn't be part of our catch share program. They'd be excluded. I just wanted to bring that up to make sure that I hear from you on that as to whether we're missing something there, or is there some other idea about how that wouldn't be the case?
Gee, Sam, but, you know, we've had this discussion, and I can't remember what the final outcome was. But I think some resolution was that. I thought it was if it was taken in by a federally licensed vessel during parallel and federal seasons, not during a state season, then it would potentially count towards your history. But that if that's not clear, it should be. Right now, but I have a feeling that's clarified, but I can't recall if I'm right on my answer.
Well, that was a management issue. I think if you harvest a fish inside three, that would count against your quota. So that was a catch accounting issue. But the bigger issue was if 50%+ of the pollock are typically harvested inside three, can the federal government issue quotas on those fish?
Well, because the quota is a share, if you would take the share based on your landings wherever you caught them, I believe, I think that's where it goes, unless it was landed in a state fishery. So you would get the share, but if in the future the state said, we want 50% of the pollock for state licensed vessels, so create a new group of stakeholders, you know, your share would be on federal, you know, based on the whatever the was left of the federal tax, the federal amount. I think that's how it would work.
That would work with cod. Obviously, now it's 30% of the federal APC is state water fishing. There is no state water pollock fishery other than the parallel water being open, which is a state fishery technically.
Yeah. I think under the current thinking about the program is that wherever you caught them, they would account towards your history, regardless of which side of the line you were on.
You know,
but I'd have to double check on.
You know, I think that you're just making there. Here's the crap out of me, because if you take a look at all of the IFQ fisheries, all of it. Crap, whatever, has been put into place. Every time you put one into place, you take a look at what you've done in the past. You take catch share, and I agree with that part of it. I mean, catch share is a targeted species. But what you're doing by taking that and putting it into the bycatch part of it as well is you're rewarding the guys that fish dirty. And that pisses me off. I mean, I was on the board of fish when there were some guys that fished dirty in a pollock fish. I mean, not a in a scallop fishery, and put in a half a million panic crab in 5 days and kill them walk away with no repercussions whatsoever. And but we're going to do that and allow the guys to fish dirty, because the fish where they were fishing dirty is where the main part of the pollock was, so they get
guys at Fixed Parity.
I think the way the program is set up is to do exactly what you want, to create a penalty for somebody that fished dirty in the past.
But you were saying that bycatch quota would be taken along with the targeted species, and that person would get X number of bycatch, not unless you went into a co-op fishery, and that's not necessarily the best thing. I mean, you could come up with all kinds of scenarios, but...
I think this is how it would work. I think, say, for example, Ernie caught 100 tons of pollock, and he caught 100 Chinook salmon with that. Maybe I caught 100 tons of pollock, but I didn't catch a salmon at all. Now, when the council would issue the way the current framework program that will be analyzed is that we would both get 100 tons of quota for pollock, but you have a pro rata of your salmon, which means that I would get five salmon. I would get five salmon. That's, say, the average salmon bycatch across the fleet. I would get five salmon to work with. So I'm good. I'm not going to catch any anyway. I've done something. Maybe I just got lucky. I don't know. I get five salmon. He gets penalized. He used to catch 10. Now he's limited to five. Okay? Now, if he wants, under the program, he could maybe pay me to sell him a couple of my salmon. Or maybe he and I are in a co-op, and we're sharing that our five fish apiece. So we're sharing those 10 fish. And so he can ask me, and I can say, well, yeah, I've fished most of my quota. I've got my 10 fish left, but I bet I hold back two. I've got my five. Go ahead, Ernie. Use eight. You need them. I only need two. So I think the initial reward, in other words, he's not going to get a bycatch quote. He's going to only be issued the quota share for perhaps his cod and his pollock. But I think there's a certain amount of salmon and halibut that go along with that share. So he's going to be penalized because he had bad bycatch, and I'm going to reward it because I'm going to get extra more than I probably need because I was a clean fisherman. I think that's the intent.
I totally understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
On the equation part of it. It's just that if you take a look at the whole thing and you take the whole equation, it's reach a safe can out there. And take a look at it. I mean, every community out there is declining, and it's declining really fast.
Yep.
Because a lot of the revenue that's made out of the fishery has not gone back into the community. And that's not taken into consideration in these equations. And take that point, for example, we've gone from 150 systems to 100 systems. And I don't want to get into the debate part of it. I'm just pointing out some points that should be taken into consideration. Delta Lagoon lost their school. There's a couple, three other ones that are potentially going to lose their school in the region. And it's because the income is not coming back in, and all the costs are going up. I don't know if rationalization. I mean, you take a look at IFQs for all of it, and perhaps it's not any good, and I'm not sure if this one will do the same again. Somebody's going to convince me, and you have.
Well, just that the value of the shares that you will get are going to be worth millions. So in some way, it infuses a lot of money back into your community just from the value. Okay, how those get dispersed in the community, I can't tell you, but there are probably going to be some kind of community provisions that allow some community ownership of shares. But that's not on the table right now. That was discussed and it was kind of dropped off, but there may be a play.
I'm not advocating community share.
Yep. Well, I understand your concern. I wish I could tell you that the price of fuel was going to drop and the quotas were going to triple, but I can't.
Community share, for example, with the label license that you took away from the basically that are in this room, and we all have it. So I might not have used them because of economics and different fisheries. Turn around and give them to an entity within our region. They turn around and lease them back to the exact same people and charge an exorbitant amount for a lease, and it just doesn't work.
going to be to my benefit to catch as many fish and as much bycatch as I can to get the past history I have and get the more history I'm going to get for this year and just sort of take my lumps for the fishery shutting down.
Yep.
And I'm going to have a bigger percentage. So that does incentivize us. Until that program is in place, that incentivizes me to fish dirty.
Yep.
And we've seen that. We see it this year. We see folks that come in from the outside, and to them, it's clear. Bycatch be damned. I'm going to get as much as I can, and nobody else is getting anything. I don't care about bycatch. If the fishery shuts down, I'm going to have the lion's share of this quota for this year.
Right. And like, for example, in the fall pollock fishery, there was a fair percentage of salmon showing up, and the local guys stood down, and some bigger boats from the outside came in and fished. And, you know, they weren't listening to us.
There's no question that the council giving some indication that there would be a catch share system and rewarding based on quota for the past, you know, and that's, people have known that for a few couple of years, has resulted in a real race for fish. And,
yes,
you know, bycatch be damned. I think many people understand that. And that's probably another reason why there's interest in moving forward very quickly on this thing. Now, they did set a control date of, you know, the history after that date won't be considered in the initial allocation. But based on past history, I'd be doing the same thing as you.
I'm not saying I should do it.
Sometimes the council has they can move beyond what their control date was set, including history. So the rational fisherman is going to be racing, is just like you described. So that doesn't surprise me at all. And so, you know, I wish I could tell you that, you know, the council could make a decision and say, absolutely not. This is it. You guys chill out. We're not even going to consider this year. And I, you know, cross my heart, hope to die, we're not doing it. But I can't. Can't. Because the longer the program drags out, the harder it is to justify why you've reached back 5 years to when you close the door and you're not considering any fishery after that. So I hear you totally.
I don't know how many management options NIF, National Marine Fisheries, has in between now and the period that we do have a control date. But my suggestion is that we look at any management options we have to prevent that rational behavior that I said I should be doing.
Yep.
And there are some options we have, whether it be, you know, staggering, how people, I mean, I think you really have to look at management options to prevent the rational fisherman. I catch be damned, let's get as much as we can. And that's between now and the control date.
I'd say that the council would be open to any suggestions you have on how to do that and within the federal system. It's, you know, again, it takes a long time, and it can be very, very frustrating. That's, you know, probably one of the drawbacks of the federal managed system. It's slow. On the other hand, it's very well considered. You know, when they make a decision, it's thought out to the nth degree. It might be the wrong decision from your standpoint, but it's fully considered. So, but it is slow. Anyway, I'll be here for a while, and anytime you see me, talk to me.
I have one other quick one.
Yeah, fire away, Sam.
On the Observer program, the original expectation was it was going to cost, the Observer expense actually was about twice as much as was originally expected, so therefore you had half as much coverage. And it was, I think, the fishermen that are in the partial coverage category are paying 1.25% of their gross to cover the cost of the program. Is there an expectation that the more observers and therefore more money, or costs like to go down, or what's your crystal ball saying about the future of the expense of the program?
Well, what I've heard from the Observer program is that they seem pretty happy with the coverage that they had this past year, and they seem to be happy with that 10-14% coverage they're going to get next year based on the fees collected this year. Of course, the first year of the program, federal government put in a lot of money to kickstart that. And now the money for next year is what was collected from 2013. But they seem pretty happy with the data coming in at the current coverage level for the partial coverage category. Being able to have a more even distribution of those observers across fisheries, rather than lumping them all on a certain vessel size of a certain type and not getting the data from the rest of the fleet, or getting it in certain seasons and everybody was playing games with it, you know, to try and work around it, I think they feel a lot better. I think that the whole intent of the program was to get better data, and they think that they are getting better data. So I don't see... I think it would be a really tough argument at this point for them to say, we need more money, we need more coverage. I mean, it would take maybe, you know, the cost of observers truly to skyrocket or something for them to do that. And, you know, there's a lot of hope and momentum behind the electronic monitoring program to be able to enhance those MAPC observers. So, you know, I think both of those things could interact.
So when do you see the tender observer issue being changed? Is that going to happen in 2014? And if so, like in the early part of the year? I mean, it seems like the wheels turn kind of slowly, but I was just wondering.
I am under the impression that they intend to... basically disallow the tendering trip issue for 2014. I think it's so important.
Disallow, I mean, that means you send
they would
observers out on tenders to...
They would disincentivize you from delivering to tenders to avoid the observer thing. So they would say that delivery to a tender is a trip. In other words, not dock to dock. It might be every delivery is.
So that means you might have to go
an offload would be a trip.
Pick up an observer after you.
You know, I don't know. I don't know enough about the program, really, the details, to be able to understand how the observer deployment might occur from a tender, or, you know, I don't know how they would determine that. In fact, I don't. I'm just thinking out loud about how they would go about and regulating around the tender observer issue.
I mean, the reason we use
it, but they've raised it, and they're
fishing in remote areas that so we don't have to go back in. I mean, obviously the convenient thing would be to place observers, send them out on tenders, so if you need a person, they can. You don't have to go back to town.
That would be a good idea. Now, if that may be exactly what they have in mind, I don't know, but I do know that they have expressed intent to try and tighten that, what they see as a loophole, sooner than later. Because they're worried about their data, you know, the evenness and distribution and integrity of the data. If they're missing this component of, you know, fishing around tenders,
that's what they're concerned.
We're
already close enough to the upcoming season that we're, you know, I mean, it'd be sure nice to know what the heck the deal is, you know.
I'm hoping that their explanation to the council in December will reveal those details. I don't know. The observer program kind of operates outside my radar screen.
Because for us, the PopCon, you know, for me to add cost, for us to get back to King Cole is almost impossible.
Yeah.
Servers can tell us 3-day trip we've got to go in.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't think that the observer program is going to be entirely irrational about that. I don't think they're not going to allow tenders are allowed. I don't think they're going to disallow it. I think they're going to try and figure a way that they can get the data that they want without disrupting all your fisheries and costing you ridiculous amounts of money and wasting fuel and time. They don't want that. They just want their data. And so I think they're aware of the problems of the people in charge of the observer program. Really, they understand your fisheries because, you know, they've deployed observers for a long time.
We have to run into one day to run out.
hear you. I like I said, I think the Observer guys know that, and you know, maybe they'll do their analysis and realize that their data issue that they raised is not that big of a deal. I don't know. I just know that they've raised that concern, and they said that they intend to address it as soon as possible. But I don't know how.
A couple years ago, we did the catarrh season and then the federal season. What time we got our pots out there? We fished 5 days.
5 days.
5 days.
Wow.
Oh, every day counts for us.
Yeah. I understand the price is really in the toilet right now. You're still racing for fish.
Appreciate it, Dave.
Yeah. Well, glad to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Good chance. We're going to switch gears real quick, switch computers, and move from the Fed system to the state system.
Right. Thanks.
Which I would say is probably a faster process.
Yeah.
So still very public, and yeah.
Great. Well, hello, everyone. I'm Glenn Haight. I'm the executive director of the Board of Fisheries.
Do you want to do it on here? Or?
No. You need this one.
Yeah.
Sorry. We'll do some setup here. Here you go. Hopefully, there's enough. Folks. So maybe just a little bit about myself and what I do. I work as the executive director for the Board of Fisheries, and I've just been on for 2 months, so you will see at various points here my responses to certain detailed questions may be pretty general. So it's been interesting getting going. Look at my role here is at the Board of Fisheries is one of really trying to maximize public involvement and participation in fish and game management. What you won't see our shop do a lot is prepare the research that goes into it. That's the role of the other divisions in fish and game. And certainly the decisions of the board members are their own. So it's been pretty interesting watching the first couple meetings. So, just real quick, Fish and Game has a booth over at the expo, and I'll be there at various times. So, if you want to get together and talk about things from the stuff we talk about today, let me just swing by and try to find me. All right. So, a little bit about myself. In the past, I had worked early on in helping oversee the CDQ program. In the 90s, very interesting. See a few CDQ faces here, and some of the same issues in terms of multi-species allocation were dealt with by that CDQ group early on. So it's pretty interesting to see how this goes. It's extremely complex. Certainly appreciate how folks are working on it. I worked for the Department of Commerce. And that got me involved with Aleutia a little bit, and then also helping establish the Regional Seafood Development Association that's out there. And I'm curious to see where that ends up. And then I, at one point, had worked for the Marine Advisory Program and taught some financial management classes out in the villages, worked with Andy out in King Cove. Of course, no one showed up to my class because it was really boring, but that's okay. I was able to go to the high school and where I got a captive audience. It was interesting. The one boy that was the most interested had earned $30,000 that summer with his dad, and he was definitely listening to what I was saying about balance sheets and income statements. And some of the other kids weren't quite so tuned into it. So it was a neat experience. And you guys live in some of the most beautiful places in the world. Really have to say that. I'm from Juneau, born there. Talked to my son just before the meeting. They're getting 18 inches of snow, he says. So, for those that are back in the communities, I want you to know it's pouring down rain here. It's an awful day in Seattle. It's horrible. I wish we were home. But, okay. Hopefully this will go well. I actually had this, a lot of this was put together by, oh, we've got animation here. I'll run through it quickly. By Susie Jenkins Brito. I don't know, is anyone here, well, show of hands, maybe on the advisory committees in your communities? Folks, okay. Great. Yeah, Susie is our regional coordinator, and we'll talk a little bit about the advisory committee system to the extent that you don't know about it. We've got one of the neat things about the Board of Fisheries is that they employ the advisory committee system so that all the proposals are vetted at that local level first, and then they move out to the Board of Fish, and we have minimal budget, but it allows us to bring people in, which is, I think, a neat part of it. Or, of course, we'd love to have more resources for it. Take this off. But at the very least, it's a great way to have folks engage. And Susie is in the Dillingham office, but she works as the regional coordinator for your area, and I can just assure you she has everyone's respect at our shop and throughout the department. She's really great. So if you don't know her, I would recommend getting to see her. I guess on this first slide here, these are the things we'd like to talk about a little bit. Members of the Board of Fisheries and some of the process, to the extent we need to cover that, you probably all know it very well. I want to provide just a couple bullets on what happened at the most recent PCOD meeting, and if we want to stop and talk about those things, that would be welcome. Other meetings of importance for the rest of the year, we have the Chignik finfish fishery coming right up in a couple weeks, and then later in March, it's the statewide king and tanner crab fishery. And looking into the future a little bit, we've got Alaska Peninsula and Aleutian Island. A meeting will be in the 2015-2016 cycle. And then I want to provide some remarks on the Fishing Game Advisory Committees. So for that Alaska Peninsula Aleutian Islands fishery, that is, for those that are writing down dates in the future, it's the February 23rd through March 3rd of 2016, and it will be in Anchorage. And of course, proposals for that would be then due April of 2015. Yeah, Ernest?
Quick question.
Sure.
And that meeting is in conjunction or a day between the
Yeah.
Which is new.
Which I can. Oh, I'll skip that slide when I get to it then. That was a slide out of place, really. You know, Ernie's right. That's a work session for the Board of Fisheries. They agreed to move the Chignik subjects into this meeting. There's eight proposals coming up for the Chignik meeting. It barely it's just at that point where it's really expensive to hold these meetings, so it doesn't make a lot of sense. So they're going to merge that in with the Area M meeting, and so you'll have I don't know if there'll be a day in between or not. We haven't got to that point, but merge those together. Thanks. No, I appreciate that.
Proposals March 2015.
April.
April 2015.
Yeah. So these are the board members that are currently serving on the Board of Fisheries. Carl Johnstone is chair in Anchorage. Tom Kluberton is the vice chair in Talkeetna. John Jensen's in Petersburg. John's, I think, the longest serving member of the Board of Fisheries. He's been there a while. Reed Risky's out of Fairbanks. Sue Jeffries, Kodiak. Fritz Johnson's the newest member out of Dillingham. And Orville Huntington's out of Wuslia. So those are the makeup of the board. A very, very diverse group from all over Alaska. And it's been interesting just my first couple meetings watching them work and understanding where they're coming from and where their experience is. It's pretty fascinating. I don't know if it's really I'll talk a little bit about process here, although again I suspect everyone knows well the Board of Fish process, but in general, the Board of Fisheries acts as an extension of the legislature. A long time ago, legislators realized they didn't want to be making these incremental decisions, very politicized, hard decisions to make, and so they created this body to do this work. And so they will change components of fisheries management. They'll create new fisheries, as we'll talk about. They have a pretty wide level of authorization in fisheries. So it's an important group to dial into. In terms of the process, The Board of Fisheries will look out 2 to 3 years in the future and set meeting dates. Of course, they have a 3-year cycle, so they'll take up regions every 3 years. PCOD was a little unusual. I guess that was on a two-year intervals, but they did not set another CivicOD meeting date, so that's not out there at this point. So proposals, a call for proposals will go out, and they'll be turned in April of the April beginning of before a meeting cycle starts. So again, for the next area M, which is in 2016, those proposals will be due almost a whole year in April 2015. The department will review all of the proposals and provide reports on all of it in the various divisions. Certainly, some are more applicable. Some divisions have a bigger role in some proposals than others, and it's been interesting watching that process and watching the divisions work with each other in terms of coming together with reports. Of course, the public is public comments, and the public will comment all through the process. There's a deadline set for written comment. I think it's really important to meet that date if you can. Excuse me. But even after that, all the comments that come in are included and provided to the board members, and they're welcoming comments all through the process, even at the meetings and into deliberations. So there's a process in place for that. And of course, they meet and deliberate and debate and decide on proposals. A good tool, if you haven't seen it, is the website that the Board of Fisheries has. It shows all the meetings and all the record copies that were provided at the meetings, and then the most recent edition that the group had before I got there was actually having the audio available, so you can go back and listen to specific things. It takes a little bit of time to navigate and understand how it works, but it's pretty well written out. I don't know if anyone's had a chance to use it, but you can pretty quickly get to the area of discussion that you want to hear about, and we'll just try to keep making improvements to that website. A couple other things to talk about. There are a few mechanisms and ways to get something in front of the Board of Fisheries. Of course, you have the proposals, but that takes a lot of thought in advance to get those out there. If something comes up and you want to have the board consider something out of cycle, there's the agenda change request process. So 45 days before the first board meeting of a year, there is a deadline to submit an agenda change request. And you essentially try to convince the board that you've got something that meets some of the criteria that they have for considering something out of cycle. So that's done in the work session that happens in October. There is a proposal in place that will be, I think, deliberated at the CHGNIC meeting about extending the deadline from 45 days to 60 days. So you need to get it in probably early August for an agenda change request. That's actually going to be deliberated on. The other one is an emergency petition. That's if something happens that meets the threshold of an emergency. Really, it's about typically about something that's going to harm the resource. But there's other criteria. We can look into those if you'd like. And I don't know, Ernie. Do you want to just do questions as we go, or should we get through? If you have any just questions as we go, I'll do my best to answer them. All right. So let's talk a little bit about the PCOD meeting that was held. I apologize in the handouts that I had the wrong date on there initially. So it was the 18th to the 22nd, and so I think a number of you were there at that. That was my first official Fisheries Board of Fish meeting. We had the work session, but it was interesting to watch. We had a number of ACs contributing to that. When I say ACs, I mean advisory committees. A number of ACs contributing to that. They will produce. The advisory committees will meet well beforehand, and they'll go over all the proposals that they're interested in and then submit recommendations to the board for each proposal that they'd like to, and that's done through the format of minutes. And then the advisory committees will come in and testify. And typically, the board will allot 3 minutes for public testimony, but the advisory committees get 10. And they do listen to that. They look forward to it, and they really rely on it. So I would encourage you again to jump in with them. Susie just put together, when she was putting together the slideshow, she listed a couple of the proposals that were of interest for folks in Listen's East. The first one was, this one here, of course, is to increase the GHL in the Western Gulf region from 25 to 30. The original proposal had it at 50%, and so they didn't approve to do that, but they increased it to 30%. So in terms of AC support, King Cove and Falls Pass were in support. Sandpoint actually opposed it. So, and that was opposing the 50%, but I don't recall particularly how Sandpoint talks about it at the meeting. But so that was, I don't know if you guys want to talk about that one at all as we go, or? That was the only, I think that was the only PCOD GHL that was increased. There were several others considered. There's one that seemed more on the technical side of things, of a clarification for weather delay criteria, language of past, and this was not controversial at all. There was a proposal to allow for 7 days of pot storage on the grounds. Apparently in 2011, the board had taken some action that had changed that, it removed that ability. It was very costly to do all the running around, and so they put that back in. So for the pot fisheries, you can have 7 days to leave your gear out there. So that was, again, that was not something that was opposed by anyone. Proposal 35 was to establish that new PCOD Bering Sea fishery in Area O. So that was something that was quite new. So it's a state fishery in the Bering Sea for PCOD. 3% of the ABC is going to be available. So that was an interesting one and well debated at the meeting. I don't. Yeah, no.
No.
Okay. I'll lean on other people here too on some of the details. What I wrote down. Thank you, Ernie. So the exclusive. There. Yeah.
Yeah. That's my understanding.
Dan might know better. I found it interesting. That's why I was at my first board meeting. I'm busy trying to make sure that facilitating the process, and I didn't have time really from my time I started in the month before the meeting to study up on a lot of these ones. So. I was a weak study on certain things that happened, but there's a couple things I wrote down from the substitute language that carried on this, and it's in the it's on the website if you want to read it, but it's less than 58 feet vessels will start 7 days after the closure of the Bering Sea Aleutian Island hook and line and pot fishery and fish up to August 28th, and then there's the ability to open it back up if there's remaining quota out there. And I've got 60 pot limit on that too. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Question. Please.
First question there. I know the planting is going on now, so there's some effort to identify what the ABC is going to be for the Bering Sea, and I can't remember what the numbers were, but last year it was in the neighborhood of. Something like that. So 3% of that, I'm just trying to put a number on how much fish is going to be available in Area O.
Mm.
I don't know if you can do any quick math on that, but if you say, Dave and I were talking earlier about what the plant team is going to recommend for quotas for cod and Bering Sea.
Right. Yeah, I don't have any current information on that. Do you know, Dave? Or?
I don't.
Okay. We'll get to that later.
It's going to be a significant amount of cod in Area O.
Yeah. We could also dive into some of the staff reports that were available. That's going to have that, I think. Have a good handle on that.
That's a pot fishery only with a 60-pot limit, 58 and under. Is that the deal?
Super exclusive.
Super exclusive?
Just exclusive.
So this is an interesting one. Proposal 37 at the Board of Fisheries was to create a Natka mackerel fishery in the Western Gulf, and it was a seine fishery, or to start a seine fishery for Natka mackerel. And at the end of the day there, it was approved 10% of the tackle was allocated to the fishery. And so we have, since that time, we did receive an emergency petition from the ADAC Community Development Corporation asking to rescind that. And so the board's going to be deliberating on that next Tuesday. And so there's an emergency petition in action. The corporation was very concerned about the potential impact that this new fishery might have on National Marine Fisheries Service deliberations on Steller sea lions. And there's been some primary concern that they had was there's some pollock allocation for the Aleutian Islands that hasn't been made available for, they haven't had a consideration of this for over 10 years apparently, and they're concerned that there could be a favorable decision in later on in the winter, but with this new fishery, it might heavily impact that. So that was the nature of their petition, and so the board will be hearing that and we'll see where that goes. The emergency petitions are temporary, 120 days. They're in effect for 120 days, and either the board needs to take it up and make it an official decision on it within 120 days, or they can delegate that authority to the department. That'll be up to them to figure out what they want to do. Either way with this one. So in terms of the Central Gulf Civic Cod, there wasn't any changes to the GHL, as I mentioned. They did move up the start date for the Chinook fishery. There's a lot of concern that the small boats in Chinook weren't catching as much as they could, because some of the larger boats would come in and really catch a lot of the fish right towards the end. So there's a lot of debate about what to do, and at the end of the day, the board said, well, let's move up that start date and just give them a little bit extra time to catch that fish. And so they thought with the development of the Bering Sea fishery, increasing the GHL further out west, those measures would keep some of the larger boats, more powerful boats, out those fisheries, and just to give a little more time. So that was how they sort of arrived at dealing with the Chinook issue, which did have a lot of discussion and debate at that meeting.
And it sounds like a lot of these measures would benefit Western Gulf.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. Well, and certainly there's. While there's not a lot of social economic research that's developed for the board, there's not those resources in place. It seemed to be dominant in their minds and in their discussions and deliberations was getting more resources out for the communities. Certainly, right? That was talked about a lot. Yeah. Well, just a little bit on the Chinook finfish meeting that's coming up in a couple weeks. It'll be at the Egan Center for those that may want to join. Again, there's only 8 proposals, and so we don't expect it to go too long. Apparently, we'll have a Sandpoint AC. We'll be there. And Susie thought the proposal 39 might be of interest, and I won't know the details as well as some of you may know about this. But it seeks to change the management plan for Perryville and Western Districts to be managed based on abundance of pink chum and coho salmon, and is it Stepovac? Good, in the Shumigan Island section. And this is my Ernie slide. This one lets you know that the Chinook's getting lumped with the Alaska Peninsula Aleutian Islands. So that's going to be on. That's effectively now a 2-year cycle as opposed to 3. So it's going to be heard again. And the other one of perceived importance here for folks in Aleutians East is the final meeting of the year, the statewide King and Tanner fishery, King and Tanner crab meeting. Will be at the Sheridan March 17th through the 21st. And a couple of proposals here that that Susie thought would be of importance. Proposal 340, which clarifies the gale warning criteria to align it with the National Weather Service, but then probably more interesting, Proposal 342 to change Area J Tanner crab fishery opening from January 3rd to January 15th. But, you know, there's a lot more proposals, and so it's, if you haven't had a chance to read through them, you'll want to. Of course, they're available online, and if you need some better directions than that, I can help you with that. So just a little bit about the advisory committees that we have in Aleutians East. There's the Nelson Lagoon Committee, one for King Cove and Sand Point and Falls Pass. Currently, Susie says that the only one that hasn't met recently is the Nelson Lagoon, but I'm not sure if that's still current. But otherwise, they're meeting to discuss and deliberate on these. And what you have here the chairs, current chairs, Grant Newton in King Cove, John Foster in Sand Point, Tom Hoblett. Are any of you guys here?
Tom is here.
Oh, hey, Tom. Okay. In Falls Pass. You can get elected, and each it depends. So I mean, I would have to turn to Tom to see how they do their elections. But you'll have nomination. People who want to be on the board, or excuse me, the committee will be there and put their names in, and they'll hold an election at the meeting. Is that consistent, Tom, with what you do? Yeah, you know, and there are some ACs that are sort of regional based that might have several members from different communities, and the communities themselves hold those elections, and so that varies how they choose to do it. But it's a pretty interesting process. There's two communities here that aren't, you know, on the AC list, and it's Cold Bay and Accutan, and I couldn't tell you why that is. I don't know if anyone here knows what went into that, but those, I'll follow up further on that, but as I was preparing for this presentation, I noted that, and not entirely sure why. You know, a couple things in terms of the advisory committees. We had a joint board meeting, and that was actually right before the PCOG meeting. And subjects of the joint board meeting were largely about advisory committees and structure and process there. And then the other big component was subsistence. But it really did bring to light a lot of the nuances of the advisory committees and some of the problems that they're having in terms of influencing and impacting the boards. It was, I think, a very important meeting. From that, what we've started to work on in-house is some training modules. We heard from the advisory committees. They got together with the boards and had a leadership session, and we talked about various training components that would be good for new members who are on ACs. And so we'll be rolling out with six or so new modules that our regional coordinators can use, and in fact, any educator could use. So if you're on an advisory committee, you've got some new people that you'd like to have here on certain subjects. So they range from some of the really important but technical things like how to run Robert's Rules of Order meeting, and then an overview of how the statutory system works. So there'll be that, but there'll also be subjects like how to influence the board at a meeting, how to write effective minutes, how to run an effective AC meeting. It'll be a general kinds of training that we'll have available. So I want to throw that out there. We're also going to have new web pages for each AC so that it'll list who the board members are, committee members are, a little bit about the committee and what it does and what it represents, and then a listing of all its past meetings with minutes on it and the agendas and what was discussed. So that'll be available for people in the communities. And then the last thing we'll do in-house is we're trying to develop an advisory committee recognition program, because there's a lot of people that have been serving a lot of years and doing really good work, and they're telling us they're having trouble getting new recruits and people who want to take the time and serve. And so I think one of the ways to help with that is to build a culture of recognizing some of these people who have been working for so long. We'll work on that too. And I do have instructions from the board to take a look at advisory committees and possible restructuring. I don't really know where we'll come with that, but really Southeast may be the issue of their interest right away, because in the Southeast you've got a lot of single town communities that are inactive, and so I don't know what it'll involve with your area, with the Southwest area, but we'll be taking a look at possible restructuring. And we'll put out a survey and get your input and try to get a handle on what might be changes you'd like to see made. Yes, sir?
Yeah, I've got a couple of comments on your restructuring. I've got a little bit of time I might spend on an advisor board standpoint. So. But, you know, years ago, when you had your advisor boards come in, when you had your, you know, the general population had 3 minutes or whatever in front of the board, and the advisor committee had 10. But once you got down to deliberation, the advisory board chairs of the effective proposals sat at the table in front of the board. And as the board went through their process, talked about issues, whatever related to that proposal, a lot of times they would have questions. So the advisory committee chairs were sitting there and they answered those questions. Well, at some time during the process of the board of fish board, a lawyer became the chair. And I don't know if it's because it's a lawyer or what, but that part went away. And they instituted all these committees.
Right.
So instead of the board actually doing the work that they're set up there, they put it into these committees and had them do their work for them. Well, if there was 4 or 5 committees set up, but you really wanted to participate in 3 of those 4 issues, you couldn't.
Right.
You could spread yourself between them. So to a lot of people in the area, by the board itself setting up these little committees and having people work that way, took away from the issues that you were there trying to get across and get regulations changed and help manage fisheries management.
Okay.
And I think probably some of the issues with getting people to get back on the advisory committee is they don't feel like they're any better than Joe Public as far as going to the meeting.
Okay.
And I think if that changed, that would change a lot of what you see in relationship to advisory committees attending and participating in the process.
Okay, thank you. Can I just ask, what year was that generally when ACs were sitting at the table?
It's been the 80s and 90s. I think I sat as chair for
15, 18 years. I asked that because that was heavily discussed at the meetings with the Board of Game and the Board of Fish talking about whether they wanted to do that. So I'll look into that a bit more. Yeah,
just prior to what Alvin is talking about, back in the '60s when formed these advisory committees, they were the only ones that could participate in any of the debates. So everything was basically done by the advisory groups, not bringing a consensus of the communities that were represented. It's open season now.
Okay.
So you'll go right. Come in there, depending on how good you are at presenting your story. It changes regulations. Some of that's really unfair to the communities that are.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah, that was one of the proposals. The advisory committees that were there had got together and said, "Hey, we would like a seat at the table." And as I try to recall some of the conversation, that's something that the Board of Game will currently employ at times. It's not formalized, but if they have a question that they're stumped on during deliberations, they will call someone up, or I'm not sure how it works. Having not attended the Board of Game, I think the Board of Fish is one of the things, and I don't think it's consistent throughout the regions. But when they look at a complex area like Cook Inlet, and all the various ACs that could or should sit at the table, you might see 10 to 15 that would be there. And boy, how do you deliberate through 300 proposals? I think it's for me the observations were just the sheer amount of work. And how would you logistically work through it? I think but that they recognize the point and the value. So, but I'll look. I thank you. I'll look into this, and I think it's something that we can ask people about when we talk to the ACs about that. Yeah, interesting. Okay.
Detail on that point, would it require a board change, formally change its procedures, or could they elect to, in the case of, for example, Area M, would there only be 2 or 3?
Mm-hmm.
Flexibility to say yes, this way it makes sense, whereas Cook Inlet, there'll be
That would be one of those questions they turn over to the Department of Law and ask. But I would think if I was engaged with what the Department of Law would say, they would say that's not.
This makes so much sense because sometimes, you know, like this is, for example, this last one, the proposal to increase the GHL from 20, and one of them was 51 to 55, so then the board said, okay, here's our motion, 30. Well, at that point, there's no more opportunity for public input, including the AHD.
Right.
It seems like it might then be the appropriate moment where they ought to be allowed to weigh in.
Yeah, I certainly the table would get bigger, depending on what region you're dealing with. But I don't know. Yeah. I suspect it'd need to be across the board, though.
You know, at one time during this process, the state also put in place regional advisory committee. So there were like, I don't know what there were, four or five in the state. And I think like Area M and Kodiak, Crystal Bay were all in the same. So we would have, you know, we had a chair, vice chairman. So all the advisory committee chairs would get together for those areas. And if there were actual proposals that we all agreed upon, then it went, then when the chair of the regional would sit in front of the fisheries board and say proposal 9, 11, 16, whatever, was reaching out of institution by all the advice committees. And then they just kind of basically walk through it and ask those.
Right.
And then if there were, of course, if you're in Area M, AYK, you'd have like a
time.
Then those would have to go, you know, into discussion. But it kind of helped streamline the process. They did it for, I'd say, 4 or 5 years, I think. And then it fell apart.
Stop doing it. Okay. I appreciate that. That was another suggestion they had. We need to meet regionally. That's all I had in terms of formal discussion. It's pretty light. I think there's some contact numbers for folks. Again, Susie is your regional coordinator, and Frances Leach is the publication specialist that we have that does the Board of Fisheries, so she keeps track of all the material and the audio portions of it, and you can call me and give me a hard time about other things that are bothering you. But, yeah, question, Sam?
Just one other real quick example and a process question. The CHCNIC meeting here, we noticed there's a proposal to allow to change the definition of when fishing is finished, for example, standpoint, and CHCNIC now, you're finished fishing when your rings are up. And apparently at Kodiak, you're finished fishing when you're hooked up with your skiff. And it seems like it might be good to have that as a standard definition statewide, yet it's only going to be in front of the board for CHCNIC, this meeting.
Right.
If somebody was to suggest that it ought to be considered statewide, how would they do that, or at least for one or two other areas?
Yeah, no, that made sense. When we were talking about it before, in terms of how to forward it, would I think be a board generated proposal. So at any time, a board member can take up a particular issue. There's certain criteria that they've laid out that needs to be addressed and discussed before they'll actually take that on. But that's a mechanism to have something seen out of cycle or discussed out of cycle. But it has to be the board needs to do that. Come forward.
They couldn't do it at the CHCNIC meeting.
I think they could draft it. You know, it could become a proposal that could be deliberated on later.
Plenty of notice then.
They'd have to notice it. Yeah. But they could open it there.
Yeah. Of course, the risk is then that if you can open back up Area M for one little detail issue like that, that there may be some sort of piling on. Other people want to ask. Hey, I've got an idea too.
It's always a good caution. They are, as a general rule, asked to deliberate on sort of the essence of what's in front of them, and not stray too far. But that, of course, there's no guarantees, and so I'm going to be careful about it. Any other questions or just discussion points you guys want to talk about? I could just facilitate that. Or,
I just want to thank both of you very much.
Thanks, Ernie. Appreciate the invite.
We'll probably sign off the teleconference here pretty quick. But my other two announcements are I wanted to thank Laura and the mayor and the assembly for helping us get this together. Laura went through a lot of the work to get this going. Thank you very much, Laura. And the booth.
Okay.
Thank you,
Laura.
Yeah, thank you. Any information comes my way, I usually put it on the website and then we'll have it on the back of my card. And then finally, I'm going to put something on here, which I'm calling the Unimac Bite Report, which was a product from the survey biologists. They're going to spend some of our money to survey a little bit an area that hasn't been surveyed since they did pox surveys. And so I'm looking for any information from the guys in this room who know about where they might find some more crab. So I'm going to put the picture on the wall. They found some trawlable area, and reports on the website. I had copies, didn't bring them. But I'll put part of the pictures on here. And if you got any ideas where they should spend their time, they spent a little time this summer just kind of spot checked. And in the 2014, they're going to cooperate with us, put a little more time in. Please come and see me if you know where they should turn. And thank you guys very much. And we got the room till 11, then we got to be down. Any questions from the public or please talk amongst yourself.